for joining us for another edition of the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. I'm Eric Pfeiffer from Hoosier Ag Today. Glad to have you along. And we like to kind of run the gamut here. We've been with the Indiana Beef folks. We've been with the folks at Indiana Corn and Soy. Today we're with our friends at Indiana Pork. And we've been talking about some issues in the pork industry for some years now from a policy standpoint. I'm glad to have them on board. Josh Trinari is here, the executive director of Indiana Pork. Josh, thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, good to be with you today. I appreciate the invitation.
And we also have Jeb Stevens.
I've been listening to your back catalog.
What was that, Josh?
I've been listening to your back catalog.
Oh, appreciate that. Jeb Stevens is also here. Jeb, give us a little bit of background because you're with Indiana Pork, but you also hold some other positions within the National Pork Producers Council and some other things. Give us a little bit about Jeb.
Sure. Just a quick, simple rundown. First of all, thank you for letting me join you guys this morning. But born and bred Indiana corn soy farm kid with a passion for pigs. Attended Purdue University. Currently work with an organization in Southern Indiana as their swine business unit manager. And then own an operation in Miami County, Indiana. Currently serving on my second term on the National Pork Producers Council and active board member with Indiana Pork today.
Well, we thank you for joining us. And I'm really excited to get into a lot of this here because, again, there's a lot going on in the pork industry. And really a lot has come to the surface here yet again. We keep talking about Proposition 12 out of California. And we're going to get to that here in a moment because I think, once again, it was a big topic of conversation at a recent event that y'all were at, the World Pork Expo. I want to go there first because this is an event that I've wanted to get to and just haven't had the opportunity to get to over the years that I've been with Hoosier Ag Today. It sounds like a fun event. Pork producers are some of my favorite people. I think it might be the bacon that you guys produce. That might be why you're some of my favorite people. It's like the best food in the world, so that might be it. But World Pork Expo, you're going to have to take me through this. Is it just like a big bacon lover's dream to go to this thing? That's how I envision it, that there's just bacon everywhere. Every corner I turn, I could grab some off of a like almost a hot dog cart, but it's a bacon cart. Maybe this is just my dream, but take me through what World Pork Expo is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the World Pork Expo is kind of the keystone or capstone event of the U.S. swine industry. Two-day event currently with this current format with over 10,000 producers, 400 vendors. And like you insinuated, there is literally bacon, pulled pork, hog wings. A lot of vendors and a lot of hospitality tends to do a great job of returning that patronage and taking care of the consumers and customers there. Also, they have the big grill sponsored by the NPPC, and it's a great opportunity to indulge in a great networking event and also participate and eat as much pork as you can possibly handle. You're looking for vegetables by the end of it, to be frank.
So it is my dream, is what you're telling me. I've missed out all these years.
Highly recommend you attend.
Josh, we're carpooling next year is what I just heard. We're headed out there.
Yeah. I took my son out there this year, and if you asked him a summary of the event, it was the hotel had a swimming pool and there was a lot of free food outside. So, I mean, some of the subtlety was maybe lost on him, but he enjoyed himself anyway.
So he didn't get much into the policy conversations, but the pool and the wings he remembers. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Well, there was plenty of policy conversation had out there. I know that's where the National Pork Producers Council, they unveiled some of their big topics of conversation from a policy standpoint. And again, Prop 12 tops the list of those policy priorities and what they've been advocating for in these farm bill discussions. And when we talk about this farm bill, let me just put it out there again, guys. I've talked about this in several of these ag policy podcasts. I'm not going to put words in your mouth. I'm taking them straight from mine. It's my opinion still that a farm bill does not get done this year. That's my take. I still think there's too much partisanship getting in the way of this thing. It's just from my standpoint, not going to happen. People are still holding out hope, and I hope that it does. I just don't think we're going to get there. But at this point, we've seen frameworks from all sides now. House Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats, and we have seen a fix, if you will, for this Prop 12 legislation out of California in both the House Republicans and House Senate, the Senate Republicans version of the Farm Bill. And I know that NPPC has come out and said, like, those versions, that we've gotten what we've asked for in those versions of the Farm Bill. Prop 12 just continues to kind of be a thorn in the side of pork producers, regardless. You know, some pork producers might be complying with some of these Prop 12 requirements, trying to sell into that California market, and that's all fine and good. But it still seems to me like a bit of legislative overreach and making things just a touch more difficult for pork producers. Jeb, what's your take?
Sure. Well, obviously, Prop 12 has been on the forefront for a number of years, and NPPC and several independent organizations have worked tirelessly to continue to fight that. And recently at our National Pork Forum in Chicago, producers again reiterated the fact that producers want to maintain their freedom to operate and not see that overreach by states in the United States that don't typically raise a lot of pigs. However, we continue to see those battles, we continue to see those things, and with the recent Supreme Court decision, we've taken this fight to the Farm Bill, and we're doing everything we can to put that language in there and keep that language in there, but we've got that, but we're at the mercy of how this Farm Bill execution plays out for sure.
And Josh, I mean, right now, like we have these Farm Bill versions out there, and just about every farm group that I've seen, they've jumped out and they've said, yeah, we support this House Republican version. Yeah, we support this Senate Republican version. No one's jumped out and said anything about the Democrats' version of these farm bills. But they keep saying, well, how can we have a bipartisan farm bill if the Republicans want? Like, I guess this is the internal fight. That's why I don't think we're going to get there. What about, I mean, the national pork producers, they're behind this. I assume Indiana pork is kind of somewhere in the back of that as well here with that support of those Farm Bill versions.
Yeah, definitely. We're certainly happy with, how much attention was paid to our, kind of our wish list for the Farm Bill as you see these drafts coming out. But I leave it to the experts as far as speculating on how it gets across the finish line. But but yes, we would certainly like it to get there.
From a Prop 12 standpoint, Josh, the concern I think is that it's not just Prop 12. We're seeing some legislation in. Is in Massachusetts as well, where they're starting to do this now. I think the ultimate concern is that we don't end up with 50 different ways of doing this, and that pork producers across Indiana aren't trying to figure out, okay, what's one method that fits all 50?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it's not just producers either. It's the packers and all on through the chain. I mean, how do you, effectively segregate that production if you're trying to abide by production regulations for, it doesn't have to be 50. I mean, 3, 4, 5, a half dozen is going to, that's going to be an impossibility. And so, yeah, the goal is to try to make sure that as far as ag production is concerned, a state can't regulate outside its borders again, because that can obviously present some real challenges. I will say that, Indiana does have production regulations on the books. It's in state law, and it's a rule at the Indiana State Board of Animal Health, and it's kind of the teeth they have from an enforcement standpoint if they have to go out and address an issue. And I mean, you hear it a lot of times about like horses or dog breeders or stuff like that, but I mean, it applies to commercial livestock operations too. The whatever production method you're using to raise your animals has to be appropriate for that animal's breed, sex, and age. And if there's an issue, the Board of Animal Health has authority to go in and investigate that and make sure that's the case. And so, Indiana Pork will support any production method that meets the standard. If you know, avail yourself of any production method you want, and if you want to take advantage of a premium to sell into a market, that's great too, as long as it meets, you know, the standards that apply in our state. And we've got producers here that are doing that, and that's fine. Our goal is to make sure that we don't have multiple, you know, state level production regulations coming down the pike that fragments the industry even more.
And Jeb, I know as a producer yourself, these make for difficult decisions. And again, you don't necessarily have to talk about whether or not you did or didn't comply with Prop 12, but just the decision-making of a pork producer, there are a lot of things that go into this, largely the dollars, right?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. I mean, obviously, economics do play an important factor in any business. I mean, we're in the business for profit, or to raise pigs for profit. But we also look at things like animal welfare and employee safety, and just doing a good job doing what we do. And you know, as far as that goes, making the decision to convert your facilities to Prop 12, I mean, if it makes economic sense for you and you're given the opportunity to do so, that's great. I think most producers just want to maintain that decision and that independence. They don't want to be forced to do something that, you know, impacts their freedom to operate.
What is, I mean, as we look down the line, I mean, obviously we've had Prop 12, and I think, I mean, you guys tell me, did we learn a lot about this process as Prop 12 moved through in California? Did we learn some things that maybe as an industry, and I say we collectively, the ag industry, did we learn some things that maybe could have been done differently in trying to, for lack of a better term, fight against Prop 12 that maybe could have prevented this? I mean, Josh, you tell me, with your legal background, are there some things we could have done differently?
The way I look at how it all shook out, you know, over the multiple years it took to, you know, to get that case to the Supreme Court, I mean, it took a lot of advanced planning to craft that lawsuit in a way that, you know, once it was kind of moving through the process, that it would be one that would sort of have enough priority or have enough broad implications that it could even be considered by the Supreme Court. And that takes a lot of advanced planning, and we really got to give credit where credit's due with the team, the NPPC and AFBF, and the experts they hired to navigate that process. And what I like to tell people about that process is, regardless of the outcome, that process had to happen, because, you know, look how hard it is now, right now, to get Congress to take a look at a legislative fix. And if Congress had the excuse still that, well, this could get addressed in the courts, why aren't you trying to address this in the courts? And that would be their way out. Well, they don't have that anymore. Regardless of the outcome, the Prop 12 litigation needed to happen, because you have to take that to the ultimate decision, and that was the Supreme Court. And it didn't go in our favor, but it gets us on to the next step.
That's fair. That's fair, absolutely. So as we go forward now, and other states are doing the same type of thing, I guess, you know, maybe that is what we take to the folks in Congress. Like, look, now that this has happened, other states are trying to do the same thing. Only you can prevent wildfires. Only you can prevent this from happening in other places, because they're going to keep trying it in other states. I keep hearing about this other measure in California where they're trying to do, you know, some kind of furthering this thing. We don't need to get into that a whole lot today, but it sounds like, you know, these animal activist groups just end up with a lot of this money, backed by a lot of people, and it seems endless. That's the way to combat this. We've got to get Congress to act.
Yeah, that's right. A legislative fix is about the only option at this point, because it's a battle you got to fight on several fronts, especially with the vulnerabilities that that states that have a ballot initiative process provide to the activists. It's a real challenge.
You know, one thing that I think is important too, though, it is a call to action for voters and for consumers in the state. I mean, you may not be an active pork producer, but if you do see a ballot initiative in your state, or have some questions on your ballot, being an informed decision maker about what you're actually voting for. The way that question was written, I mean, anybody wants animals to be well taken care of and completely understand that. But I don't think they realize that at times, the price of their bacon was going to increase significantly, or there may or may not be a meat shortage. And the average consumer wants safe food, and they want it at an economical price. And they still put a lot of trust in producers and us as farmers to raise that pork in an effective and healthy way. And just being informed and making sure you're aware of the decisions you're making is a huge thing. And that takes a concerted grassroots effort. I mean, we have a population that's very removed from agriculture today.
I've got a note here that they've seen a price hike in California of around 41% on pork products. Can you imagine the uproar from some Hoosiers if we saw a price hike of 41% on bacon? I mean, imagine this Hoosier right here if there was a 41% price hike on bacon. That'd be bad news. Anything else here on Prop 12, guys? I mean, this is something that has been... For several years now, we've just been following this and then waiting for that Supreme Court order to come down. And Josh, you mentioned, the Supreme Court, they essentially said, this is a problem. This is something that should be taken care of, just not by us. Like, guys, this is something that should be fixed. We're just not the ones to do it. We have to clean our hands of it, right?
Yeah, that's essentially it. And yeah, back to, sort of final thoughts you asked about on Prop 12, I guess I think the price hike thing you're talking about is probably the best thing to end on, because, I mean, after all, that's the priority, is that, consumers in the California market, if they're expecting to be able to purchase safe, affordable, quality protein, they're not worried about the political dynamics of a state regulating outside their borders. They just want to be able to afford, good protein, and we want to be able to give it to them.
And on that note, I'll finish that conversation with this, and unfortunately I can't remember his name. Jeb, you would probably know it because you've probably worked with him, but the NPP president from last year, I believe, was speaking about just that, the price hike on pork. And talking through this entire Prop 12 process, and he didn't want to talk about the price hike that pork producers would see in implementing some of these things to comply with Prop 12. He didn't want to talk about all of the regulations and all of the things that pork producers might be handcuffed with to try to make all of this happen. He wanted to talk about the kids in California that used to be able to have pork as a reasonable option because they were hungry kids. They were kids that were less fortunate, and pork was a reasonable option for them, and now it's not.
Yeah, and I think that's very important to know. So that individual's name was Scott Hayes, and he's current active past president of National Pork Producers Council. Great producer from Missouri, huge family man. And I think it's important to note that was aligned by the entire NPPC and the board there. Even when the final decision from the Supreme Court came out and that ruling was made, the legal staff there at NPPC and the board was all in favor of making sure the flow of pork in the state of California was as seamless and smooth as possible, probably even at the detriment to producers. But more importantly, the consumer is ultimately who you have to work for every day as a pig farmer, whatever state you live in, and making sure those consumers had choices and were able to access that product was important to us. And we did our best efforts there to make sure that happened and executed well.
He was worried about hungry kids. And I think that is the heart of Indiana pork producers, U.S. pork producers, U.S. farmers. I think that's the important thing to take away.
I think that's why we farm every day. We feed the world.
Amen. Let's move on to some of the other National Pork Producer Council priorities that were announced there at the World Pork Expo. Another big one, market access programs, and looking to expand those as part of the Farm Bill. Jeb, if you want to explain to folks what market access programs you're talking about there, and really what you're looking for as far as growth.
Sure. Well, you know, last year the U.S. pork producers exported $8.6 billion worth of pork to well over 100 different countries. And I think it's important to note that U.S. producers are really good at raising pork, and exports at whatever level are a significant key to our success in maintaining those exports. So any of those free trade agreements or countries that are taking advantage of free trade agreements, I mean, staff at NPPC is gonna continue to push to fight for that market access and keep those channels of pork moving, ultimately just to maintain the price and economic features of producers in the U.S.
And that was a big part of the job of former Undersecretary at USDA Ted McKinney, Hoosier. He did that under the Trump administration. I know things have changed now under the new administration, and I know that there's been talk of wanting more trade action out of the Biden administration as well. So we'll see if that happens here as we get later on in this administration, and what happens come November when a new election is had. Again, I'll keep some of that away from you guys. You don't need to go talking about election, unless, you know, Josh just unmuted. You want to talk about the election, Josh? You want to go there?
I unmuted to talk about trade. It's a policy podcast, and I have a policy not to talk about the election.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought maybe you wanted to weigh in on the election, but trade, you can go ahead. All right.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess I would say priorities ebb and flow depending on, you know, what the climate is as far as trade goes. And you know, there's not a lot of motivation right now to open new markets, but that doesn't mean there isn't work going on. And so, you know, NPPC on the policy side, you know, they're the ones that open those new markets and keep them open from a policy standpoint and advocacy standpoint. And then once you've got the market, you still have to gain that market share. And that's where, you know, National Pork Board investment or the U.S. Meat Export Federation investment, all working in tandem with these market access program dollars and foreign market development program dollars through USDA are really important. And it's not just us either. I mean, all of agriculture benefits from that. I think the statistic is for every dollar spent in those federal market access programs, it adds $24.50 in value to U.S. agriculture as a whole. I mean, that's a no-brainer investment.
So moving on from trade here, another thing that we want to talk about from a priority standpoint, protecting herd health. You know, this is something that we talked about a couple podcasts ago with the beef folks as well. Just because African swine fever hasn't been an incredibly hot topic here recently doesn't mean that it's just gone away. This is still something that pork producers are really looking toward, looking at, and making sure that we keep away from the U.S. African swine fever is still a topic of conversation. Whoever wants to tackle this one, go right ahead. We're still on the lookout here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, African swine fever is a devastating, you know, foreign animal disease that will wreak havoc on the U.S. swine industry if it gets here. And remaining vigilant and continuing to be vigilant, even if we have, I think it's termed ASF fatigue, just from information overload. But, you know, I think it's important to note that we do have African swine fever in the Dominican Republic. That's not that far from the coast of Florida. And, you know, we have a lot of retail and a lot of tourism and a lot of vacationers that go there, you know, weekly. And you know, making sure that we have a strong Beagle Brigade and we have strong information at all of our ports of entry for consumers and vacationers and tourists and whatever, just to understand the ramifications of what could potentially happen if there was a slip up with that virus, for sure.
You mentioned it really could devastate the U.S. hog herd. And up to this point, I think, you know, a lot of folks like to get on USDA about a lot of things, mostly when they put reports out. But USDA and other agencies, they've done a pretty good job with this one, keeping ASF out of the U.S. A lot of work has gone into this.
Yeah, I think you really have to give credit where credit's due. And the USDA has been very proactive and worked really well with the Beagle Brigade and the Farm Bill and seeking funding for those initiatives to make sure that they're as informed and prepared as possible. So, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I don't want to change the subject, but I just, while we're on the topic of giving credit where credit was due at USDA, I mean, I would say that extends to Prop 12 as well. I mean, you know, I think Vilsack has made comments about the need to address Prop 12, both, you know, in front of the House and the Senate, and we certainly appreciate the administration's stance on that, both, you know, through the lawsuit and through this effort now. So
it was pretty incredible. I know that they kind of, like, the administration joined the lawsuit. I mean, they provided comments in support of pork producers and Farm Bureau during the lawsuit.
I definitely don't want to get us off track of the biosecurity foreign animal disease conversation, but yeah, that's worth going back to just to underline that. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Jeb, going back to that biosecurity issue, what changes have you made on your look? I mean, there have been changes here over the past several years. I know from many pork producers from this biosecurity standpoint. I mean, talk through some of those changes and what folks have had to do here over the years, just to kind of be mindful of things.
Well, the good thing, you know, for modern U.S. swine producer, biosecurity is at the forefront of a lot of decisions we make every day, because it does matter for some domestic diseases as well. So a lot of those immediate changes have just regarded around things like pig flow, truck biosecurity and sanitation, and more importantly, just increased vigilance through secure pork supply or certified sampler program, so we can execute and communicate and be ready for that when it does happen. Also, with the recent development of AgView, just to track animal movements across the country and make sure we know where those points of entry and access points are coming and congregation of animals is occurring.
Let's take a time out here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. When we come back, I know that Josh had some other topics he wanted to tackle here from an environmental standpoint. Also, the Indiana Pork Board met just a couple days ago here, and they were talking about some priorities for the upcoming session here at the Indiana State House. It's rapidly approaching. I know it's June, but we've got this budget session that is coming up sooner than you think. We'll talk about some of those priorities here as well on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast.
Podcasts are everywhere today, but how do you find the one that has something you're really interested in? The Hoosier Ag Today Podcast Network is your one-stop shop for podcasts covering Indiana agriculture, farm policy, farm news, agronomy, soil health, ag biosciences, and more can all be found at the Hoosier Ag Today Podcast Network. Check it out on the Hoosier Ag Today mobile app and at HoosierAgToday.com.
Back here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Welcome into Hat Studio 3A, West Lafayette. Eric Pfeiffer here from Hoosier Ag Today. And I'm joined by Josh Trenary, Executive Director with Indiana Pork, Jeb Stevens, Indiana Pork Board member, and also board member with the National Pork Producers Council. And we are talking Indiana pork policy. And before we move on to some of the environmental issues and also some issues facing Indiana pork at the State House this coming session, let's go back to this biosecurity issue here. Josh, I know you had some things you wanted to add here. Again, we're talking African swine fever and some other issues. And again, African swine fever, it was real hot and heavy You know, when it first came on the scene here at HAT, we haven't touched it in a little while because it hasn't been circulating quite as much. It hasn't been in the news, which is a good thing. No news is good news, but that doesn't mean you guys haven't you haven't turned your back to it. It's still a priority for you.
Yeah, you know, Jeb mentioned, you know, ASF fatigue, and that's a real thing just in the general populace, and but also amongst pork producers. You know, pork producers are being asked to do all this preparation for something that isn't here yet. But a lot of the preparation, as Jeb alluded to when he was talking generally about biosecurity, a lot of the same type of preparation can help with things that are here right now. So, you know, Jeb mentioned the Secure Pork Program and AgView, and there's other software mechanisms out there that producers use to, you know, to track their movement data for pigs, because traceability, you know, is a key component of this process. You know, if you get a disease, you gotta be able to, you know, trace where the animals are coming and going, and sort of put a boundary around that in an attempt to regionalize to get your trading partners back on board. And that makes traceability a key component. But again, it's a key component for more than just African swine fever. So if you look at the poultry industry, they've been, you know, they've had a program set up since the 30s, and it's run through USDA. It's called the National Poultry Improvement Program, where they have traceability mechanisms in place. They have testing and disease screening in place, and it's a very advanced system so that those producers can keep an eye on their flocks from a biosecurity standpoint. And the pork industry is in the beginning stages of developing something much the same, and it's running in two parallel tracks, I would say. One is the creation of the pilot project known as the Swine Health Improvement Program, U.S. SHIP. And so U.S. SHIP is a body of delegates, and there's a committee that manages it, and they adopt standards and practices for what, you know, this sort of disease screening traceability mechanism would look like in the poultry industry through a similar administrative process that the poultry industry uses. And the goal is to hand it off to USDA as a regulatory program similar to what the poultry industry did years ago. As a part of that, and this is what the parallel track is there's also traceability standards that National Pork Producers Council producer delegates have adopted as something they think the industry could manage after a lot of, you know, consternation and debate and sort of negotiation on what, you know, what is effective but also practical from a business standpoint. And then that list of traceability standards has been submitted to USDA as well, as sort of the first step in creating traceability regulations at USDA. So that means that this Swine Health Improvement Program effort that's just in the pilot phase right now becomes doubly important, because it will be the mechanism by which producers can enter into this U.S. SHIP program and be working with these standards right now before SHIP becomes a regulatory program, but also before the traceability regulations submitted by NPPC to USDA go into force. So the goal is, you know, over the long term, that SHIP can kind of ramp up the industry into this new era of traceability regulations and more advanced disease screening in the industry, and that'll help us with ASF and a host of other health issues that we already have in this country. So
it's a lot to take in, you know, with this biosecurity stuff and ASF. Again, I'm glad that I haven't had to talk about it in a while, but you never know when it's going to pop up again, and we really need to have all of these things in place for when I do. Hopefully I don't, but let's have everything in place before that happens. Again, this is the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, and we're going to get to those statewide priorities here in just a little bit. We've got that legislative session coming up here before we know it. But Josh, you wanted to touch on some environmental priorities that are happening now at the federal level. We just had a conversation from the Indiana corn and soy standpoint about some environmental priorities here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. What's happening from your standpoint at the environmental stage here for pork producers?
Yeah, sure. I definitely like an excuse to talk about Clean Water Act stuff anytime I can, so I'll bore you with it for a few minutes here. But there's a couple things going on here, and they're, I guess, doubly interesting to bring up in an Indiana context, because Indiana deserves a pat on the back for being proactive about it years ago. The one thing that's going on is a lawsuit from, you know, it's the typical players, Food and Water Watch, and then if you get down to the state level, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, North Carolina Environmental Justice Network. They're constantly challenging EPA on how, you know, they manage the federal concentrated animal feeding operation rules, the rules that govern large livestock operations. And this has been, you know, a give and take in different versions of this litigation going back to 2005. And part of the argument is whether or not CAFOs should have an ag stormwater exemption. The idea that there's only so much of this you can control, and if you land apply manure at an agronomic rate and you've met all the standards and there you do get a rainfall and there is some runoff, that you're protected by that stormwater exemption, because it's an impossibility to address all of it all the time. The other part of the debate is the idea that under the Clean Water Act, you can force a concentrated animal feeding operation to get a federal NPDES permit. And we've been on both extremes of that, from basically having to prove that you weren't discharging, which folks did not feel equipped to do. So you saw the industry, you know, largely getting NPDES permits for a time until 2010 in the Fifth Circuit, when they said, well, you know what? Clean Water Act doesn't, there's no Clean Water Act authority to force these CAFOs to get an NPDES permit unless they have an active ongoing discharge. And we don't have active ongoing discharges. The only way manure leaves our facilities is if we take it away and land apply it at an agronomic rate. We're not discharging from those production sites. And so, to Indiana's credit, in 2011 and 2012, we worked on a new rulemaking under separate state authority to move all of our livestock operations out of that federal NPDES program, because they don't discharge. We took that Fifth Circuit decision to heart and worked with IDEM and other industry groups and crafted a rule that rolled the CAFO regulations into the confined feeding regulations that were already in place in Indiana for smaller operations and just made it one big state rule. And now, so, you know, the standards for those smaller operations were modernized and, you know, those regulatory requirements were raised up a little bit, but it created a rule that, you know, as a delegated authority state, EPA Region 5 was comfortable with, and now we regulate all our farms in Indiana without, you know, that federal involvement of the NPDES program, which is great. And one of the reasons to talk about that today is because that lawsuit's going on right now that's going to challenge that again. But the other lawsuit that's going on is San Francisco versus EPA, where they are looking at some provisions in municipal discharge regulations in San Francisco, where EPA, even though there was no clear violation of the standards and the permit they were already operating under, EPA is trying to impose narrative standards. And what I mean by that is just sort of a know it when you see it thing, no specific numbers or anything. They're trying to pose new narrative standards to their permits, and they're doing so even though there's been no clear violation of their old permits. So San Francisco's saying, wait a minute, we don't know how we're gonna comply with this, and we don't know that we should have to deal with any changes anyway because we haven't done anything wrong. And so, you know, folks are watching that one to see, well, all right, it'll be interesting to see how all this shakes out. How much leeway are we going to give EPA in this type of regulatory environment? But what's nice about Indiana is, you know, because of the proactive approach, again, in, you know, 2011 or so, we're once removed from all that because we're regulated by the state now.
You know, we do things right here in Indiana.
Well, once in a while, at least. I like to talk about it when it happens.
Seems like all the crazy stuff happens out there in California. We do things right here in Indiana. So, Jeb, you looked like you wanted to weigh in there.
You know, the only thing I want to weigh in on, you know, the state of Indiana is very fortunate to have an individual like Josh Trenary that thrives on environmental regs and policy. The guy is very good at it. He does a good job looking out for a lot of advocacy and policy groups here in the state. Thanks for that, Josh.
So, John, this is kind of your thing. This is like your background, right? What did you do before Indiana Pork?
I have worked for Indiana Pork since shortly after I was, barred as an attorney for a variety of different regulatory issues. I would say on the water stuff or just general environmental stuff, I was mostly trained by a lot of the Farm Bureau staff that really helped me out early on, especially like Justin Schneider, who's not in there anymore. He's with Indiana American Water, and folks like Mark Thornburg, who are still there, were definitely very helpful in sort of training me on how to look at this stuff, and that's been a big help. And also Michael Formiga with the National Pork Producers Council. He used to be just their environmental council. He now oversees a lot more of those activities out in DC for NPPC. But the environmental stuff's what I like to do. But this effort, you know, back in 2011, 2012, it took a lot of people and a lot of IDEM staff to make it all work. And so certainly appreciate all that effort. But yeah, thanks, Jeb.
Let's wrap this thing up here, guys, by talking about what's happening at the state level. I know that a lot of groups, probably right there where you're at, Josh, right there at the barnyard there at Keystone at the Crossing, which is an interesting place to put a barnyard, but it's the barnyard nonetheless. Getting together and talking about what's going to take place here at the State House, because it's going to be an interesting session, budget session coming, and we really need to get some of these priorities for agriculture to the forefront. I think that it was said a lot in this past session. It's a pretty light session for agriculture. Not a whole lot going on. There was really one big story for agriculture that pretty well took over the whole session and even made some national headlines. But really that one bill was largely it. There were some other smaller things here and there, but for this next session, I think there are some things that really need to be looked at and taken care of. What was discussed in the Indiana Pork Board meeting on Wednesday that really needs to come to the forefront for Indiana Pork and for Indiana agriculture?
Well, I guess, yeah, going back to 2023, the way we kicked off our policy discussion at the board meeting this week was sort of a review of the bill we weighed in on the most in 2023, which was House Bill 1003, which was a administrative law bill. And it, you know, the livestock and poultry industry are uniquely situated in how we deal with, you know, administrative appeals, and so we kind of look at it differently maybe than some of ag or other regulated industries. But the removal of agency deference in that bill may be a challenge for us long term, so we were definitely sorry to see that deference go. You know, if you think about it, if Jeb is in front of an environmental law judge and he's suing IDEM because he doesn't agree with an IDEM decision, well, if agency deference is removed, he's got an easier time of it and has more of a chance of success, because the judge isn't going to take, you know, IDEM's analysis into account as much. But that's usually not what happens. Usually when a livestock or poultry producer is in front of an environmental law judge, they're on the same side as IDEM. And it's somebody else challenging an IDEM permitting position decision because they don't want a barn there or they don't want a barn expanded. So, you know, 90-some% of the time our members are in front or in a, you know, administrative law scenario like that. They're on the same side of the agency and they benefit from that deference, and now it's gone away. So.
Any other big priorities coming up here for 2020, I guess technically 2025 is when really
so,
moving forward.
So, yeah, no, I guess you're right. I mean, I was saying 2023 there, but, yeah, it just seems like it was that long ago. It was actually just, you know, January, February, March of this year. But yeah, that's, you know, so that was sort of a disappointment coming out of 2024. But for 2025, I guess the thing I would touch on today is just, you know, thinking about, you know, all the controversy swirling around and what you're seeing locally around the state on land use issues, especially as it revolves around renewables. And then are there going to be bills to try to address some of that at the state level, since it's ginned up such controversy across the countryside in Indiana? And then that means that, you know, if there are changes made there, or, you know, honestly, even if there's not, how many of these local ordinances are going to get opened up to try to address some of that? And then what's that going to mean for the elements of those ordinances that, you know, that govern the livestock industry? And it can be, you know, maybe things they do on purpose while it's open to address, you know, perceived issues for livestock siting and accounting, but it can also just be things that happen unintentionally in you know, internal inconsistencies in these ordinances that are created while, you know, they're tinkering with other provisions. And that, you know, that requires a lot of analysis and review and screening to make sure we're watching and making sure that stuff doesn't happen. So one of the big things we talked to the board about this week is, do we need to look at sort of the statutory, you know, minimum standard for local notice requirements on some of these things and modernize them to some extent? I mean, you know, how many people have a newspaper subscription to their local paper anymore? I mean, do we need a better sort of minimum standard for notice and something that we can track a little better as an industry? So when we know this stuff's going on, because that can be a really real challenge to us over time.
How many local communities still have a paper?
I mean, or if they have it, how many days a week is it getting published?
There are a number of issues there. I mean, I mean, there are a lot of questions that go around that. And at the state level, I mean, you're talking about 92 counties. I would imagine that over the years, there have been a lot of bills put in place that have accidentally done more harm than good than on purpose. I would imagine that takes a lot of legwork on your part and the part of your staff and everything else. I mean, that could be a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a good team to do it. I mean, they sort of informally call it the Indiana Livestock Team. And when there was a lot of growth in the livestock and poultry industry, you know, over the past several years, not necessarily in the last couple, but they did a really good job and still do have a call every week. I think they had a call at 9 a.m. this morning, I think, just to kind of check in with each other. Hey, what producers are you hearing from? What counties are the controversies in, and what do we need to look at? And if you know about this stuff ahead of time, you can get what people are considering in front of a land use attorney and get their feedback, and you can start talking to folks there locally. You can start helping, you know, arm farmers with talking points to go to those, not just the public hearings, but also those informal discussions that happen with the plan directors ahead of time. And there's a lot you can do if you know about it quick enough, but you got to know about it, because once it's on the books, you got to have standing to sue them, and they can be very difficult. No farmer wants to put the brakes on their project while they sue the county to address an ordinance provision. You know, they want to go along to get along to the extent they can, and I don't blame them.
Yeah. Well, guys, that just about puts the end of this one here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Jeb, just real quick here, I do want to ask you. You are very involved here in the policy aspect of this. Obviously, with your involvement with Indiana Pork, but also with the National Pork Producers Council, just real quick, you know, I like to ask these questions of producers. What made you decide to get involved with the policy part of this? I think it's fun to share some of these stories because it might just encourage someone else to get involved in a similar way.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And you know, there are parts of this process and the amount of time that I take that I thoroughly enjoy, and there's a part of it that is work, let's be frank. But I think it's just part of your political rent, you know, and your cost of being a good citizen and being an advocate for your industry and giving back to your community. And I think it's important to continue to do that if we want to see this agriculture business in Indiana continue to thrive, not only locally, but on a national level as well, and continue to keep consumers informed. And if we don't have the right people doing that every day, we have a great team, but, you know, people roll on and people roll off, and it's always time to continue to keep it developing and keep a good bench on any team to keep it successful for certain.
And if folks want to get involved, I mean, I'm sure – we need people to get involved, right? You talk about people rolling on, rolling off. Seems maybe of late more people rolling off than rolling on. We need people to get involved, right?
You know, yeah. Ironically, sorry, Josh, go ahead.
No, you can go.
I was going to say, ironically, you know, we had a Indiana pork producer meeting there on Wednesday, and you know, there's a lot of young, aggressive people in that room from several demographics, and I'm pretty proud of that fact. So we always appreciate wisdom, but I am proud of the fact that our organization is comprised of some younger individuals that are actively involved in their operations every day and the companies they work for, and we're going to keep doing a good job. But yeah, unfortunately, a lot of places, it's the time commitment up front when you're young and in the trenches and trying to do a good job and busy with your family that makes that extra time commitment harder to achieve, but it's just part of the process, and you have to get it done if you want to ensure the continued success.
Yeah, Jeb and I have talked about this many times. We like the fact that we always have a representative cross section of the industry on our board of directors. So we've got integrators there, we've got independent producers, we've got contract growers, and we've got allied industry folks. And what's so great about Jeb not only being willing to volunteer his time at the state level, but also make that huge time commitment at the national level, because it's important to also have that independent producer perspective that Jeb brings to those national, to that national board too, you know, especially, you know, with all the integration going on in the industry, making sure that national board has that variety of perspectives, and Jeb's a key part of that, and that's why it's so important for folks to step up and do that, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
If folks want to get involved, if they want to know more about Indiana pork, who should they call? Not the Ghostbusters, but instead?
Yeah, questions@inpork.org. We are the sort of the Indiana affiliate of both the National Pork Board and the National Pork Producers Council. So our partners on the policy side are the National Pork Producers Council, and over 2/3 of the pigs in the state voluntarily contribute to a separate checkoff just for policy issues and farmers that are doing business in this state in the pork industry. If they want to learn more about that membership, questions@inpork.org, and they route the policy ones to me, and we'd be glad to talk about it more. So thanks.
Thank you guys for doing this. Really appreciate it. A lot of great information today, and we're gonna keep up to date on this farm bill, see if things move forward. We're gonna keep up to date on this Prop 12 issue and all of the other issues we raised today. And good luck to you guys as we get closer to this legislative session here for the state of Indiana. And again, busy times, they are coming. I just know it. So thanks a lot, guys. We appreciate the time.
Thanks, Eric, and thanks for doing this. I learned a lot from other ag industries listening, again, to your back catalog, and just hearing that cross-section of issues has been valuable for me, so I'm glad you're doing this podcast.
Appreciate it, Josh. Appreciate it very much. Thanks a lot.